Welcome to New Zealand Vegan Podcast, episode 136. I'm your host, Elizabeth Collins, and I just want to dedicate this podcast to Scooter, who was one of the little mice that I rescued. He was one of the males, and he lived with his brother, Bibi, and Scooter developed lymphoma, and he got very, very sick, and sadly, we lost him on my 44th birthday, actually. I was very sad about that, but I did my best, and so this podcast is dedicated to him. So far, the other mice are doing okay. They are all geriatric now, according to the vet, because they're all around 15, 16 months old, and everywhere I've looked says the average lifespan is 1.5 to 2 years, which means they're all reached the 1.5 years almost. But I want them to live as long as possible, and I'm hoping that they're going to break all the records. I do have a couple of sick mice. Gentle Boy is losing he's went bald on his belly. I did take him to the vet. The vet said it was probably behavioral. It's not mites. Blaze is his litter mate, and he doesn't have any loss of hair. Gentle Boy's not really getting better, and I think I've suddenly put my finger on it. I think it might be an allergy to wheat. You have to be so careful. So I really do think I'll try not giving him any wheat, because that was something new that I introduced. But these things are so gradual, and you don't tie them together. Like, you don't start giving them wheat in their diet, and then that very day they sort of exhibit these things. I don't think, anyway, it's not how it happened with me. So I was trying to put my finger on it and think, well, what could this possibly be? Because it looks like he's got mites, because he's even got a little scab sort of thing along his back. And I thought, did he scratch himself? When he always squeezes up, he's so desperate for his treats, he'll squeeze himself up between the sides of where this ladder is on the edge of the cage. But I'm like, no, it can't possibly be that. It's just plastic there. There's nothing to scratch himself on. So I'm taking him in again on Thursday. I've been keeping an eye on him, and he looks, apart from being bald on his belly and having now this sort of what looks like a kind of a little abrasion on his back, but I had a look online and it was like food allergies can cause these things. And I suddenly thought, hang on a minute, I've been giving them a bit more wheat lately, mostly because of exhaustion and nerves. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But yeah, so anyway, he's fine. He eats and doesn't act like there's anything wrong, but I don't want him to be in any way uncomfortable. So I'm gonna stop with the wheat and see what that happens, but I'm still going to take him in on Thursday in case there's any medication he needs. Blaze, his litter mate, who's the fluffy werewolf, the vet had a cursory examination of him when I took Gentle Boy in, and he's got a mass in his stomach. Very hard. The vet's face became very grave, and he basically said, this is deadly. He's deadly cancer. You know, we discussed options at the age that he's at, and the things that he felt. He just said, you know, the best thing is you just give pain meds every night, and we will just keep him as happy as possible. He's not exhibiting any symptoms, and then what happens with mice, in my experience of the two mice which I have lost, is they overnight suddenly just get very obviously sick. They hide it until then, but you can sort of see it coming if you're observant. But this was a few weeks ago now, and I've been preparing to say goodbye to Blaze, and he's doing great. So he's just, it's wonderful. So the pain meds I still give him every night, and what I find is I used to try to give it to them by mouth, and you have to grasp them, and you have to hold their little jaws with your fingers and try to put the syringe in their mouth, and it's terrifying, and they're so wriggly, and they're so tiny, and I'm so scared of hurting them. So then I decided, oh, I can just put it on their oats, because they love their oat treats. Little rolled oats is one of their favorite treats. So I would squirt the medicine on the oats, and they'd eat it up, but then they catch on, and they get a bit sicker, and they start refusing to eat the oats. So what I've done with Blaze is I just remember the vet saying to me, you could I think he said if you put it on, or is it a cat? You put that on their paw and they lick it off. So I've just been putting it on Blaze's body. I take him out every night, put him on this place where he's contained, and I just chase him around with the syringe, squirt it on him. He doesn't like it, but it doesn't hurt him. But he's used to it now, but he doesn't like it. And then he's busy, licks himself off. He's like, "Oh, get the stuff off me!" And he licks all the medicine off. It's only 0.02 mils, and so that's our little ritual, and that's how I make sure he gets his pain med. It's just Medicam, and seems to be doing the trick. Every night I have a feel of his stomach. You can definitely feel the mass. I don't feel like it's growing hugely. He's acting as if he's perfectly okay, but as I said, that's what they do. But it's been a while, so it's been good to have that. It was very sad, and I was very devastated, but he's still here and he's still doing great. So there you go. So that's what's going on with them. Everybody else is fine. They're all overweight. It's except for the only mouse who's not overweight is Snowflake. I guess Blaze isn't overweight because he did suddenly drop about 6 grams, which is a lot. But he was very overweight, and then that's and I thought, oh, that's sudden. But I thought he looked so fluffy and shiny, and he looked so great, and I couldn't see anything wrong. But I don't know how to feel their abdomen, and that was kind of when I took Gentle Boy to the vet, and I said, "Oh, Blaze is doing great, but he did lose a lot of weight recently, so he's down to his ideal weight." But I just put that down to the summer heat. But the vet kind of said, sudden weight loss is not." So then he had a feel and diagnosed him with this big mass in his stomach and his abdomen. But I weigh him every single day when I give him the medicine, and he's maintaining his weight. So far so good. So, you just do the best you can, and just try to maintain. And everybody else is fine except for AB put on so much weight when I put him in the cage with BB, because BB lost his brother. AB was another male, and I made a sudden decision to put him with BB. And it was nerve-wracking there for a while. I didn't sleep much because it is dangerous. But luckily, they are making it work. But it is dangerous with male mice, with any animals put in a cage together. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible situation. Domestication is so wrong. I will fight it until the day I die, and that means vegan education, abolitionist vegan education, because abolitionists oppose all domestication. And moving on to that, I have started my university course. It's the hardest thing I think I've ever done. I've got all kinds of excuses. I'm older. I shouldn't use it as an excuse, but it is true. I mean, the older you get, the less your brain sort of maintains stuff, and I don't know. I mean, I'm 20 years older minimum than everybody in my class. I think I'm more than 20 years older than everybody except two of them. I think I'm 20 years older than two of my classmates, and then I'm about like 21, 22, 23 years older than everybody else. And they're all wonderful, incredibly bright, very gifted, very hardworking. They've all got biomed or physiology, psychology, backgrounds, or pharmaceutical or stuff. There is somebody who does have a social work background, but I don't have any of that. So I'm learning neuroscience, and the physics is what's really killing me because my maths is atrocious. And because I did sound engineering, nobody saw it coming. But I did sound engineering, you don't need to know the physics. You learn a little bit about the electricity, and then it's an art. You use your ears. So we're all a bit surprised at how badly I'm doing, but I'm gonna get there. I just have to not psych myself out. I'm my own worst enemy, and of course I feel like I don't deserve to be there, and I'm very hard on myself. I'm the most gently, I'm very empathetic mostly to other people. I know I can sound like I'm really mean to welfarists, but I'm really not. And I try to be civil, and I try to be polite, and I do have a temper, but generally speaking, I'm very kind to other people. I really am. I'm very forgiving of other people generally. I know I have a hard time forgiving welfarers. Okay? That's definitely an issue. I mean, I'm not a saint, but generally speaking, if somebody makes a mistake, I'm like, that's fine, it's no big deal, you know, come on, don't be too hard on yourself. Look, it was anybody could have made that mistake. But if I make a mistake, oh, I'm a loser, it's the end of the world, I'm embarrassed, I can't believe it, how could I be so stupid? So I definitely need to work on that because it's not helping and it's a lifelong habit and I really want to get out of it and it's not helping me at university at all because my confidence is in my shoes as usual. I have no self-esteem. And I'm like, God, you know, when am I going to figure this out? When am I going to get this together? So I need to figure it out because I can't keep doing this to myself, especially at my age. I mean, I'm twice as old as these kids. I'm supposed to be have it together. They're more together than me. They're calmer. They're more realistic. They're more laid back. It's embarrassing. I need to just get it together. So I'm working on that. Again, I'm being so hard on myself. Can you hear it? Okay. I'm just trying to work on some things. But anyway, what I'm finding really hard is, first of all, it's so much work. I don't even go on Facebook or anything unless it's to be in the group because we started a group at the of the uni students. We have our own Facebook group because we need to keep up with stuff, communicate with each other, you know, share like stuff. Like it's all about uni at the moment. It's so full on. It's so much work. I'm going to bed about 2 or 3, sometimes 4 in the morning, just trying to keep up with my studies because I live by myself. I have the animals to take care of. You know, I have to do everything. I don't have anybody to help me do stuff. I mean, you know, all the chores and stuff. There are plenty of women who do live with other people who don't have anyone to help them do the chores, of course. But bottom line is, I have to do everything. So when I get home, you know, I have to give Jebby attention. She's, you know, freaking out a bit because I used to live very close to my work, and I was literally 3 minutes walk away. So I would have a 15-minute break in the morning. I'd have an hour for lunch because I chose to have an hour for lunch instead of half an hour, and then I'd just have a 9-hour day. And I would have an afternoon break, and I would be home 5 minutes after I got home from work. So I'd come home 3 times a day to visit her, spend some time with her, and I was home at 4:35 every night. And then I'd go to yoga, but that's like a total, maybe a total of 2 hours that I would be gone, then I'd come back. Now I leave for uni at 7:30 in the morning, and depending on what's happening, I mean, we go to seminars and things as well. We've got kind of a lot of obligations that we have to be presented at these talks and things, and so sometimes I don't get home till 8, and I haven't been home at all day. So she's like, "What the heck is going on?" I mean, because I don't speak her language. You know, I couldn't explain to her, hey, starting on Monday, you know, I'm going to be gone all day and you're not going to see me sometimes for 12 hours. I just didn't have any way of breaking that to her. So she was just freaking out. And then on the first couple of weekends, she wouldn't let me out of, well, she was constantly calling me. So she was outside and just calling and calling and calling and calling me. And I just, every time I came inside, she would call me. And then the thing is, I come home and I've got so much work to do for uni, so much study. It's an incredible amount of study. So the lights on, the bright lights are on. So the mice don't like that because they don't like bright lights and they want to play. So they're not getting to play because I need the light to read all my books. So it's affecting them as well. And then Jebby, of course, wants all my attention when I come home. And she wants me to play and she wants me to cuddle. And I do, but then I'm thinking, oh my God, I've got so much work to do and I need to get some sleep. And plus, I have to make dinner. And plus, I have to do the dishes. Plus, I have to get my breakfast ready for tomorrow and my lunch. And I'm just mile a minute. And so it's really been affecting everybody. It's a big sacrifice, but it's going to be worth it. And I'm really grateful to have the opportunity and I'm going to make the best of it. But definitely is affecting everybody. So it's been 6 weeks that I've done. And it was so tiring. And I've got 2 weeks off now, so I'm finally taking a breather. I've literally spent the whole weekend in bed just because, I mean, I wasn't getting any sleep. I mean, I get up around, I think I've been trying to get up around 7 at least, but that means I rush a bit because I have to leave the house at 7:30, but I don't like spend a lot of time doing my hair and stuff, so that's fine. But I have to get things ready and take care of the mice, you know, their water, make sure they have water and their food, and then Jebby order food and a bit of cuddles, let her out, and then I'm off. And so it's been quite full on for her. For Jebby and the mice. I mean, the mice just, you know, when I finally do go to bed, then they just all come out and play really, really, really noisily. That used to affect my sleep very, very badly because of the fighting, and I was so nervous. And especially once I introduced, whenever I introduced new mice, so when I put the AB in with BB, I could not sleep because there was a lot of. They have to establish a hierarchy, and AB refused to capitulate. And for a while, I just thought it's not going to work, and there's going to be blood. But there wasn't, and everything was fine. But he was quite stubborn. AB's the one who had the terrible, terrible abscesses. When I rescued the mice, everybody else was fine, but AB had these massive abscesses, hence his name. I know that's horrible, but I was so frantic. I had 18 mice. I didn't even start naming them until, you know, so AB abscess. I was like, okay, that's the abscess boy. BB, actually, this is horrible too. Don't judge me, but his surgery where he had his desexing, sterilizing surgery. He bled a bit too much, and they were a little bit worried. They said, "Oh, he was bleeding a bit more than the others. Please keep an eye on him." So I was like, "Okay, that's bleeding boy, hence BB." I know. I just was so desperate for names. So they actually got named first because of their medical conditions, and then finally, when things were calmed down and everything wasn't so mad, I was able to name them all. But that's how AB got his name, because of abscesses. So I wonder if he's always been a little punk, because he was a bit of a punk with his sisters too. He was constantly bullying them. He wouldn't let them play on the wheels. But now he's the, you know, he finally, BB is the boss. BB's always been the boss. He was the boss of his brother. BB is not going to capitulate. But AB finally learned that, and they're okay. You know, I'm not worried about their safety anymore. But in the beginning, you can't sleep because every time you hear fighting, you're thinking, oh my God, this could be it. Because you just go online and you read about these mice. And most of the time, what you're reading about is unneutered male mice. And that's where the problems really are. But mice can really hurt each other. They're very, very, very violent when they want to be. And they can kill each other. And because they're in a cage, and because it can happen so fast, to cause bad wounds. I mean, look at AB. I mean, he had these terrible abscesses, and he was just a baby. And I don't know who gave them to him. I don't know if it was another, if it was one of his litter mates, or if it was an older brother. You know, I don't know. But anyway, he ended up being fine. But so now I can sleep a bit better with the mice, even when there is scuffling and stuff, because I know it's okay. I can finally relax. I'm like, nobody's getting hurt. Everything's okay. It's just noisy and it sounds really violent. Sometimes they're playing. So that was affecting my sleep as well, because it kind of, yeah, it took about a month but even a bit longer before I really relaxed with the boys, AB and BB. I'm getting a bit more sleep now because I turn out the light when I finally put my books away, and let's say it's like 2 in the morning and I've got maybe 4 hours sleep. The last thing I need is to be lying awake, jumping up and turning on the light and running over to the cage and has anybody heard and getting them out, and can't, you know, I don't do that anymore because I'm okay. I know that they're fine now. So I get a bit more sleep now, but I'm not one of those people who doesn't need sleep. Anyway, so that's what's been going on. But what I wanted to talk about today, getting back to the real reason why I'm doing this podcast, is vegan advocacy, obviously, veganism, animal rights. And, you know, I was a bit naive. I'm sure anybody who's done veterinary medicine or anything in the medical fields or anything in human medicine, you know, the amount of literature that refers to animal experimentation. And it's a luxury. I didn't have to read about it, but if there's audiology, I'm sure like any other human medicine field or, you know, physiological field, there's animal experimentation going way back to, you know, the 1800s, you know, and before probably, but I think it was really the 1800s where they started to sort of do audiology related stuff, you know, people's hearing, where they started to. And it's very distressing. I wrote, before I applied for the course, I wrote to one of the lecturers who does the neuroscience, because I just picked that, because I knew about animal experimentation. I knew about vivisection. I knew about it and existing, and dissection. And of course, Gary Francione and Anna Charlton wrote a book called Vivisection and Dissection in the Classroom, A Guide to Conscientious Objection. They wrote that book decades ago to help medical students and veterinary students, I think it was actually mostly veterinary students, who wanted to become vets and who did not want to dissect or vivisect, because I believe they vivisect in veterinary medicine still. And he helped a lot of students, and I was thinking, I might need that book, or I might not even bother to apply. So I wrote to the lecturer and I said, is there any dissection or vivisection in this course? And he said no. He said, but if in the history of, you know, of this field, there's a lot of animal experimentation, just like everything else. And I was like, yeah, like everything else. But I made sure I didn't have to do it. And then I just thought I could just forget about it. I thought, oh, well, you know, I don't need to, you know, I mean, there's so much animal experimentation in everything, like even modern veterinary medicine. When you get some medicine for your cat, that medicine came about because of animal experimentation. And that's sort of the legacy of what we've done on this planet, is we've had this terrible legacy of oppression. And here we are today wanting to end it. And then a lot of people will say, well, you know, you know the aspirin, or the when you were sick in hospital and they gave you those antibiotics, you know, that was from animal experimentation, blah, blah, blah. And that may be true. I mean, I'm not saying yes or no, because I don't know definitively the history. I'm guessing it's probably true, but that doesn't mean I can't oppose it. That doesn't mean that I can't be vegan and that I can't oppose it. I oppose slavery, human slavery, but I know that I've ridden on train tracks in the States, which were built by slaves. Doesn't mean I can't oppose slavery. It doesn't mean I condone the slavery that happened. I can't change the past. I can control what I do, and I can control how I behave. So this is the world we live in. And it is distressing, because a lot of the literature refers to it. And they're still doing animal experimentation today in all kinds of medical fields. I mean, this is the horrific truth. So I think it's the same lecturer who I actually wrote to, is teaching one of my courses, and we have to do a scientific paper where we have to critique it. It's part of one of our assignments, which I'm like, how on earth am I going to do that? But anyway, they're willing to work with me. They know my background, apart from the fact that they didn't realize my maths was at such a disgusting level that I was really going to struggle with physics. They knew that I didn't have a physiology background or a biology background, and they still let me in, so they're like, you can do it. But I said to him, so we had to pick. So I'd already, like, I was already thinking, oh gosh, I'm actually having to read, you know, like a lot of the literature refers to so-and-so's experiment and stuff, and I'm thinking, oh, it's really permeating this whole field. There's medical fields, is all of this experimentation on animals. And I have to say that the overriding theme so far has been, it hasn't been able to be extrapolated to humans, you know, the overriding theme. So there we go. But I'm waiting for someone to ask me, because I do say it, I mean, I do voice my objection to it. And nobody says anything, really. Everybody in my class obviously knows I'm vegan, and it is an opportunity for vegan education. I do it whenever I can. So even things like, I remember there was a birthday, somebody had a birthday, and then everybody kind of said, wait a minute, what do you do, Elizabeth, when it's your birthday, because you can't have cake? And I just said, oh, yes, I can. And I showed everyone a picture of vegan cake. And I was a little surprised, because I thought everybody knew that, you know, by now. I was like, by now everybody knows. Well, that's not true, you know. I travel in circles, you know, sort of socially, if you could even call it that. I don't have much of a social life. That was something I kind of did to myself. And, yeah, I just found it easier to withdraw. I'm not recommending that, but that's just the way that I handled things. And, you know, I'm online mostly with people who know about veganism. So, but when I do my street stall, I met a lot of people who didn't have the slightest clue. But I still kind of thought that people knew at least about vegan baking. But don't ever assume. There might be people whose circles are very small. They don't go on and see any of this vegan stuff on social media, and they haven't got the slightest clue. And you're the only link that they're going to have to veganism. That's why it's so important to not be speciesist. Okay, be abolitionist, all right? Because you might be their only link. And the last thing you want to do is teach them that veganism is arbitrary and speciesist, which is what the vast majority of vegan activism, of animal activism is, and what the vast majority of vegans are involved in. I'm sorry, it's still true that it's arbitrary, that it's a choice, that only they can be vegan and everybody else has to only cut down because they can't be vegan or they won't be vegan. And it's just, we all know. My entire podcast series has been about that. So I'm grateful to have the opportunity for them. And, you know, when we have the seminars and the person comes and talks to us, like, you know, audiologists will come and talk to us about stuff. And we go, and there is, you know, sometimes there's nothing there for me to eat. And I'm a starving student, right? I mean, everybody else is loading up their plates and putting things in their pockets, you know, to take home. You know, the cliche about students and all that's true. I mean, we are on a very limited budget. But I'm hungry. Or I eat, like, I make sure that I bring something and I'm eating my little thing. Or like the other day there was an event and there was all this fresh fruit. And then there were these wraps, and there was a vegetarian wrap, which of course wasn't vegan. I had a quick look at it. I'm pretty sure I saw mayonnaise, and I just thought, that looks like mayonnaise, and God knows what else is in there, so not touching that. But I just loaded my plate with fresh fruit, and given my schedule and the fact that I've been so pushing the limits of my endurance just to get through this first 6 weeks, and, you know, running on no sleep, I'm vulnerable, you know, to... You get vulnerable, your immune system goes down. And so I was grateful. So I just was shameless about how much fruit I took, because I was like, hey, they didn't provide for me. So now I didn't actually reach out and say, can you please make sure there's something vegan there? And Will, my friend Will, is like, you need to do that. You need to speak out and say, before these events, you need to say, I would like you to make sure there's something vegan, please. And he's absolutely right. So we'll see how that goes. But I hadn't done that so far because I can barely even... I'm so, it's hard to explain how busy, so I just, getting through each moment to moment, I'm just barely sort of surviving the day, probably because I'm not very good at managing my time, and it's sort of new to me, but I just piled my fruit plate up with every bit of fruit that I could find, this huge big mountain of fruit, and it was delicious and it was great. And I was like, yes, I'm going to eat all this fruit, you're damn right, because there was nothing else for me to eat. But then the other night we had a seminar and there was nothing at all, not one single thing, because there was no fruit. Oh, there was orange juice, and I was hungry that night, and I just had to, it was my fault. It wasn't my fault that there wasn't vegan food there. I mean, I guess, you know, you could say there was because I didn't ask them for it, but I didn't bring anything else to eat. I forgot my snacks, and I just ended up, but I did, you know, I just ate when I got home, but I don't make a big deal of it. I mean, what I'm saying is I don't act as if it's some great sacrifice and I'm like some kind of hero or something. I just say to them, my classmates are very kind people to me. As we know, a lot of people are very kind. They're just very speciesist, and you just need to break through that. But they're like, is there nothing for you? Nothing for you. And I just go, no, there's nothing for me, so I'm not eating anything. But I don't, you know, I just, that's the way it is. I won't eat it. I don't care how hungry I am. I'm not on a desert island. I'm not starving. I'm not relying on you know, I can go home and eat. I can make sure that I have snacks, and this is what you do at the moment. So, but it's a good opportunity for me to just whenever I can. But to be honest, I haven't been asked a lot about my veganism. I haven't been asked a lot about veganism from them, and I haven't had much of an opportunity to talk about it because we are so pushed to the limit of studies and. The amount of work, the sheer amount of work that we have been assigned to do and learn is overwhelming. We are all really hanging on. I think there are some who are finding it a lot easier than others, but I know a lot of us are finding it quite full on. So, yeah, there's just not a heck of a lot of time for anything. But I am, I am vegan. In fact, we went out for a shared meal, and I'm trying out this thing where I go to these things and I sit at the table, and I ordered the so I went to this I rang the restaurant beforehand, and because normally I just don't go to these things, but my friend Truk from Sydney said to me, why don't you try it and see how you handle it, and if you can't handle it, then you just can stop, but you should try it, because for her, she finds it to be a really good opportunity to talk to people about veganism and to show people delicious vegan food. And she said, whether you're there or not is not going to change the amount of food they eat or don't eat that's animal based, or it might even influence them to have a bit of vegan food. So there's one thing. And she said, it's an opportunity for advocacy that you're missing out on because you aren't finding a way to cope. So I agree with her. My family, I'm never going to do that again. They've had their chance. If they're not having a vegan meal, I'm not going. But these are people who I want to have a chance to see how I go. So I went to this restaurant, and I ordered a vegan meal. They only had really one thing. It was so funny. I was looking at the menu and I was like, oh, because it was a Thai restaurant, and I said, oh, they can have make this, they can have that, maybe they can have this. And I spoke to them on the phone and they said, oh, the fried noodles you can probably, and I was like, oh, thinking I'd get some pad Thai or whatever. So I go up to the thing where you order, and I was like, so what can you do that's vegan? And he was like, that one. And he pointed to one dish, and I was thinking, that can't be right. And I was like, oh, because on the menu even it says vegan options, but I don't know if they were just so busy, or if he was just being lazy, or if he was just being honest, which I appreciate. But he basically said, I was like, what about the pad Thai? And he said, no, none of the noodle dishes. And I was like, okay. And I'm guessing there was shrimp sauce like in everything. I don't have no idea. I'm sure I could have insisted and got a specially cooked noodle dish, but I just took the vegan dish that they had, which was rice and vegetables and ginger, and it was delicious. But basically, that was it. And I sat there and we talked, and I did actually get to speak to somebody that night about veganism, but they ended the conversation pretty quickly. That can sometimes happen. But it's funny, I was thinking, we're still the thing about living in this non-vegan world and being somebody who is really refuses to capitulate to the welfarist mindset that dominates. Every day, every single time you leave your house, you are faced with it. I mean, everybody is, any vegan is, doesn't matter what you advocate. We all go through that. We all leave our houses and go out into the street and walk around, and there it is, all around us. Evidence of it, and actual pieces of it, pieces of the victims, pieces of their corpses, bits of their skin. Sometimes entire corpses. You turn on the TV or and the advertising, you open a magazine, and there it is. And that's the overwhelming thing. And it's numbing, but it's not numbing, because the thing that I find about it is, because I know that there is a solution. Like, it's not like, see, when it comes to pollution, human pollution, I know that we can do a lot better than what we're doing. I know that we have the ingenuity, the intelligence, the creativity to really try to be less harmful. But I still think we're so harmful. We're so harmful. I try to put my head around it. I think plastic packaging, and then I think, well, unless we can all, because I buy a lot of stuff in bulk. I'm very lucky. I live close to a lot of things where I can go and take my own bag and buy bulk rice, bulk flour. I can buy all my chickpeas, beans, legumes, herbs, and spices in bulk, so I can reuse the same bags over and over and over. That includes chickpea flour and my chapati flour. And I even made a deal with Tio Pablo, who make masa harina, which is what you make corn tortillas out of. And I made a deal with them, and I went down to their warehouse. This was ages ago, and I've got still got so much of it. And they allowed me to fill my own bags of masa harina, because I said to them, "Look, I really want to buy your product, but you sell it in this non-recycled plastic packaging, and it's driving me up the wall. I can't deal with buying it. I really want your product because it's GMO free, and it's I don't know how GMO free GMO really is, because the air, I think, like if you're in a farm in California and you're GMO free, but then there's a farm a few miles up the road that's not GMO threat free, how do you protect your crops from their pollen, cross contamination, whatever. This is what I've heard. But anyway, they are GMO free as best as they can be and stuff. So I said, "I really want to buy your product." And they said, "Oh, we'll come down to our where we make the stuff and where we package everything. Bring your bags." And I was like, "This is great." And I said, "You really need to get your stuff in the bulk bins." The thing about the bulk bins is not everything can be in bulk bins. So, oh, that's right. So, yeah, so some places won't put chapati flour in bulk for whatever reason. So you can't buy everything in bulk, but I'm lucky to be able to buy everything in bulk. I mean, not everything, but a lot of things. So I can feel better about myself because I'm reusing these bags. But these places where I buy the stuff in bulk, they're using plastic packaging. I just don't have to see it. So they're getting big plastic packaging of this stuff. I know they are because it's the only way it can be transported at the moment, without getting wet or full of dust or I don't know. I don't know. Why can't they use recycled cardboard? I don't know. I think we should try more to use recycled paper, but then even the paper stuff has this plastic coating on the inside because of mold and contaminants and all these kinds of things. So, I mean, I'm sure there's a way, but like if you think about how we want to, like we talk about people living up in Greenland, right? Or we talk about the Inuit, about how if we collectively globally went vegan, we would make, if they wanted to still live where they live, we could supply them with fresh vegetables and fruit and vegan goods and legumes and all those kinds of things. But they would have to be shipped in, or they would have to be sent in, and they'd probably have to be wrapped in plastic. So, and plastic recycling, we're it's like the, what's that thing called? NIMBY, not in my backyard, is it? So I can take my plastic packaging that I got, because if I want to buy noodles, rice noodles, I haven't ever found anywhere to buy them in bulk. Countdown, which is a supermarket chain here in New Zealand, is recycling plastic. But what I'm trying to say is that when it comes to that kind of thing, I find it really, really hard to see a way in which humans are ever going to really not be polluting. I know we can pollute a lot less, and I know we can start to find ways to recycle, but recycling of plastic is this very dirty business, especially the thicker plastics. They're very toxic. The ways of recycling them are just Google, recycling toxic plastic or something, and you'll find videos of where these countries, where all our, us Westerners who don't want it in our backyard, are sending our. So, there's the types of plastic. So there's one, I think four, one, I think might be two and four. You know, the little triangle with the number. Those are quite easily recycled, and we do that in New Zealand, I believe. We recycle those. But then when you have seven and five, so those are like if you buy a packet of Tio Pablo masa harina, and it's, well, some of them don't even have a number, so you just don't even know what they're made of. And it's most likely five or seven. So five or seven is like, I've Googled it, I can't remember that. You know me, I get my facts so wrong. It's, I want to say a polymer, but I don't even know. I just pulled that word out of my, yeah. It's some kind of compound of plastics. It's very hard to break down and separate and recycle. It can be done, but it's an extremely toxic process. So we ship those all off, I think, to China, and they, have these big, you know, poverty-stricken towns where they're doing it and it's toxic and stuff. So it's not just like, oh yeah, you can recycle seven, you know, that's why it's got the little triangle. Yeah, you just go ahead and put in the recycling. It's actually further problems. So, gosh, sorry, this podcast wasn't supposed to be about plastic, but I think it's a big deal. I think it's a really big deal. I mean, if we care about the planet, if we care about the other sentient beings on it, if we care about the human beings, other human beings on it, which I do, I don't want to see injustice to anyone. And I'm so privileged, you know, most of the misanthropes in the vegan community are very privileged white people. You know, so like even things like buying fair trade and stuff. I'm on a student budget at the moment, and I'm trying very, very hard to make my savings last because I can barely cope with my studies now, let alone when I have to start working and studying again. I don't even want to think about how I'm going to cope with that. I just don't even want to think about it. It's going to happen eventually, but I'm trying very hard to live off my savings. I'm doing okay. But you know, I can't be going out and buying organic and fair trade everything like I used to without a second thought. And I don't buy chocolate or coffee. Well, I don't drink coffee unless it's decaf, because unfortunately I can't drink caffeine. It's just not good for me. My life is better without it. So when I do buy a decaf coffee, I make sure that it's fair trade, because I know I have it on pretty good authority. I trust my source that if it's not fair trade coffee or chocolate, it's slave labor. It just is. This is my source and I trust them. Now, I'm not saying fair trade is perfect. I have really got, there's all kinds of misgivings about all these labels, but fair trade, I don't know enough, but I know, I'm pretty sure, like I could say it's fact that if it's not fair trade coffee or chocolate, it's slave labor. And that's that. So that alone, okay, I just, you shouldn't be buying non-fair trade coffee and chocolate. You just shouldn't. Now, obviously, like I said, fair trade is an issue, and I investigate that and stuff, but if you're not buying even fair trade, it's guaranteed slave labor. This is what I've heard, okay, and I trust my source. And child slave labor, too, a lot of it. So if you're opposed to slavery and you're a vegan, you must buy fair trade chocolate and coffee. I know those for a fact. There may be others, but I know those for a fact. And I know that there's inherent problems in all of human food production, but I'm just saying that it's cut and dry, it's black and white from what my sources tell me. And I mean, my sources could be wrong, or things could have changed. Maybe there is some chocolate or coffee that doesn't have that fair trade certified label, but that isn't slave labor. And if you know that, and you've done more investigating than me, that's great. But I'm just saying, you know. But gosh, I lost my train of thought as usual. But I'm just, you know, if we want to be consistent, yeah. So that's what I was saying. So I was thinking about it the other day, and I was thinking about how, you know, a lot of the people who can buy biodegradable packaging and recycle this and bulk everything are wealthy people who live in wealthy neighborhoods where they have access to that kind of thing. And then they can feel even more sanctimonious about how, what a good citizen they are and all this stuff. And then poor people in poor neighborhoods that don't have access to those kinds of services, such as bulk things or organic things, even if they wanted to spend the extra money, even if they could spend the extra money on it, they don't have it in their neighborhoods. So they are buying, and they might be buying stuff that's got a really bad reputation of worker abuse, maybe non-fair trade coffee and stuff like that. And they don't have the opportunity to buy the fair trade stuff. So they, the oppressed, are caught in a cycle of keeping the other oppression going. But we know that oppression is global and structural. And so when you have white privilege, that's a form of oppression that still exists, and especially the ignorance that goes with it. So then it's just kind of this terrible sort of cycle. So anybody who's out there who's privileged enough to be able to do all of these, you know, only buy very fair trade and recycled everything. That's not the only answer. We need to help everybody be able to access those things. We need to close the gap between rich and poor. I mean, there's just so much to do. That whole ramble was basically with the aim of saying that the thing that helps me to cope with the numbing, the numbing animal use all around that just is devastating, is that it's actually very, very easy to eliminate 99% of it, because 99% is just trivial, unnecessary demand by people. So plastic pollution, vegans are just as guilty of that as everybody else. I don't really know how globally we're really going to tackle this issue of plastic. I mean, I'm sure, I mean, I know we can and we need to try, but it's not as easy as veganism is on its own. I mean, you know, like I said, you go vegan, you might even start using more plastic, because you, instead of going to the butcher and buying whatever, I don't want to talk about that, but you go and buy some, you know, seitan, which is wrapped in plastic, or you go buy your seitan flour, you know, your, what's it called, gluten flour, and that's wrapped in plastic. So that is not a solution, but veganism, so that's what keeps me going. That's what makes me, because I know the solution is there. I try not to be despairing. I try not to be despairing. I refuse to buy into this welfarist mindset of that nobody's going to go vegan, because I have seen it happen in New Zealand in the 9 years since I've been back here. When I got here and everybody was saying, you can't promote veganism, it's too extreme, nobody's going to go vegan. They were all vegan saying this, by the way, so the elitism was choking. It was disgusting. And you should see what's happening in New Zealand now. I mean, it's happening in so many other countries as well. And I know anybody who's, I don't know exactly where you, if even if anybody's listening, because it's been, I just don't even really do my podcast anymore, but if you are listening, and if you live in a country where you've seen the difference in the last, I mean, maybe you've only just gone vegan, maybe you've only been vegan for a few months, or maybe you've only been vegan for a couple of years, but ask the vegans around you, what was it like 10 years ago? What was it like 5 years ago here? And I bet you they'll tell you it was really different, because the escalation in veganism globally since, in the English-speaking countries anyway, since Gary Francione's website, The Abolitionist Approach, took off, and he started, and his work started to be read, and abolitionist advocates started advocating, and vegan advocacy began happening, vegan advocacy, moral baseline vegan advocacy. The change has been incredible, and including in New Zealand. And so there is just so much more vegan stuff here. And when I say vegan stuff, I mean there's vegan food more available in restaurants. There's vegan shoes and things more available. There are young people going vegan. Young people make stuff happen. Young people, when they want something to happen, they make it happen. So they will put the effort in. So I have seen a Facebook page here, and I don't know anything about the founders. I don't know if they support safe, or any welfarism, and they might. It might sound like a contradiction. I talk about abolitionist advocacy, and then yet everybody's still a welfarist. And maybe I should do a podcast about that, because the thing is that although it's funny, I regret. So, like, for example, there's a vegan food fair coming up. Or what I'll just finish telling you about this Facebook page. Sorry, I'm doing what I normally do, I'm just all over the place. So there's a Facebook page which was started by two young vegans. It's called A Guide to Vegan, and they have researched probably the entire supermarket shelves to and contacted manufacturers and stuff to find out what stuff in the supermarket is vegan. And there's stuff in the supermarket that I wouldn't have even dreamed was vegan. I wouldn't have even bothered to look at it. And you know, we mostly it's like the processed food and stuff like that. And I always try to tell people whenever I meet anybody or somebody writes to me on my page and says I'm going vegan, but I have such a hard time, where can I buy nutritional yeast, or I don't know where to get vegan cheese, and I'm like, forget the nutritional yeast and the vegan cheese right at the moment. You know, veganism is not about fake cheese and nutritional yeast. It's about eating without any animal products, and you don't need, like, I consider those things luxury items, and I said you need to learn the basics, because you might not be able to afford the luxury items and the processed food. And the one thing I will tell people is you do have to learn how to cook, and especially in New Zealand, unless you're a millionaire and unless you just want to eat unhealthy anyway, because all of that processed stuff is so unhealthy. And I mean, yeah, if you want to eat unhealthy, I mean, I used to eat really, really unhealthy. I'm not the healthiest person, I'm not the kindest to myself, kind of, you know, on my body. But what I'm saying is I'm very honest with people in that regard. I don't use it as an excuse. I still tell them it's easy. I say, but you are going to have to cook. Okay, that's just it. If you want to eat vegan and you don't want to spend a fortune and you don't want to, and you don't want to just eat salt and chemicals all day, you have to learn how to cook. Because I mean, you can just buy vegan salami and vegan cheese and just and vegan bread and just buy some vegan mayonnaise and have that every day. Okay, fine. For one thing, it's ridiculously expensive. It's 10 times more expensive here to buy that than it is to buy the non-vegan versions. I'm not kidding. I mean, okay, maybe 10 times is an exaggeration, but I'll give you an example. Like a block of vegan cheese is something like $15 or something like that. A punnet of vegan yogurt, and I'm pretty sure that non-vegan cheese is probably like $5 for like a kilo or something. I could be wrong, maybe it's more, but like we're talking like a few hundred grams, like 300 grams of vegan cheese, and they'll charge you $12.99 or something. It's ridiculous how expensive things in New Zealand are. But you can buy a big bag of lentils for $5.99 or go and buy them from the bulk bin, even cheaper if you go down to Sandringham or some other places in the city and you buy it from the big, big stores, you know, the Indian stores or Pakistani stores. You can buy a lot cheaper, but you are going to have to cook them. You can't just rip open the packet and start eating. But I always tell people that. I say, you know, this, learn how to cook the basics and then get into the fancy stuff. If you want to start trying to learn how to make seitan and all this kind of stuff, but don't start there because, that's my advice. I mean, if you want to dive right in there and you can do it and that's great, but my advice is make your basics, your beans, your lentils, your deliciously spiced food. You don't have to have Indian spices if you don't like spicy hot. You can have a delicious chickpea dish with coconut, and you can put just a bit of turmeric or just some herbs even, and have it with rice, and you have this delicious thing. You know, you can make bean burgers and things. I have no problem telling people, because that stuff you can just slap together. So like you grab some beans, cook them up, mush them up, slap together a patty, or like there's this great what are these things called? Split peas. There's this green split pea patty, which is great. You just pan fry it and they make the yummiest sandwich stuff. So, but you are still going to have to cook it because you're not going to go out and buy them from the supermarket. Or if you are going to buy some vegan patties from the supermarket, be prepared to pay like $15 for like a box of four or something in New Zealand. So I do try to keep it really simple, but I don't even know where I was going with this. But basically, I don't know why I was talking about that. Sorry. It's been so long since I've done a podcast, but mostly I just wanted to talk about the change, about how I'm with new people who, and I did go to this restaurant and I had my vegan meal and I did stay there and I coped. I didn't look at what anyone else was eating and I blocked my ears whenever anybody else talked about it. And that's sort of what, it's shocking. I mean, if only... There's really no comparison, I don't think. I guess there is in some places. When I'm talking about comparison, I mean, when you are in this world and you're vegan, the world that we're in now, unless you live in a certain, maybe live in Portland where there's vegan restaurants everywhere and all your friends are vegan, but generally speaking, even in places like that with a really high level of vegan population and high level of vegan options and restaurants and stuff, you're still bombarded. It's just, you are so bombarded. And I understand why people get despairing and overwhelmed because, sorry, I just got a message on my phone. But remember that the solution is easy, you know, to do. It's not like trying to eliminate all human pollution in one day. You can go vegan today and somebody else can do it. If you can do it, somebody else can do it and eliminate that insane amount of animal exploitation from your clothing, from your shampoo products, from your personal skincare products, from your food, which is the vast majority. And that is an elimination of that. We can eliminate domestication. It's doable. I mean, it's actually doable. Can we eliminate all human pollution? All human harm? Because of the way we live, there's so many of us. Because we're, you know, we live in places where, like I've said this before, we don't really physically belong. We have to have heating, and we have to have insulation, and we have to have all this extra clothing, or we have to, or I don't agree with air conditioning, but some people would, you know, be mad at me for saying that, or we have to have air conditioning. So we live in places where we don't physiologically belong. So the pollution of our lives is astonishing. And I really want to see us address that, and I would love to be part of a global movement. I mean, I wish we were there already. I don't, you know, I'm trying to be part of the global movement to eliminate domestication. That's my life's purpose. You know, I don't dedicate, I don't work, I don't get paid to do it, and I don't do it 24 hours a day because I have animals who I have to care for, ironically, domesticated animals, and I have to pay my bills, and you know, I have to cook my meals. Well, I've got gas in my house. I moved into an apartment where there's a gas oven. Do you think I don't know that that's polluting? I know that that's polluting. I know that, you know, my car, when I drive to university or when I drive my animals to the vet, I mean, this is what I mean, that overwhelms me, but animal use, we can get rid of that. So, and I'm not saying we can't get rid of, I think we can evolve to the point where we are, I would love to see us evolve to a place where we did not pollute as much as we do. I mean, that's what I want to wish I could be part of. And I still, I mean, obviously I still am. I'm not saying you can't do both at once, but you know, I really want to abolish domestication. That's what I really want to see happen in my life. And I think it can happen in my life, but it may not. But it doesn't matter whether it does or not. I mean, it does matter. I want it to. But what I'm saying is it doesn't mean that I'm going to give up, or that I'm going to be despairing, or that on my deathbed I'm not going to think, oh, well, it's never going to happen because it didn't happen in my lifetime. I know it can happen. It's not going to happen if people don't fight for it to happen, though. That's a fact. It's not going to just happen spontaneously. It's not just going to happen on its own. I mean, we have to advocate for it. I mean, I want to see an end to sexism and racism and heterosexism and everything like that. We have to make it happen. It's not just going to go away on its own. But animal use is anybody can stop using animals. 99.9999% anyway. Like, there's some stuff which we don't have much control over, things that are literally out of our control at present, unless you want to just injure, like, don't exist anymore. And I don't advocate that. I don't advocate for self-suicide. So, you know, but we can all work together. But I would love to be, you know, part of the movement where there was no more domesticated animals, and we were busy trying really, 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 really hard to clean up the mess that we've made with domestication. We've made a huge mess of the planet, and also just with, because we're so speciesist, you know, we've made a huge mess of the planet. I think on a vegan planet, we wouldn't even dream of using fossil fuels because of the risk of oil spill and because of the devastation to the environment. And we would concentrate on using renewable energy like wind and sun, solar power. But then you have to build solar panels, you see. And they're not just made out of bits of grass that grow organically. You see? Oh, gosh, I could drive myself up the wall thinking about that. I just try to do the best that I can, my very inadequate way. But when it comes to ending domestication, we can do it easy, because there's zero, we do not need at all to breed any animals into existence for our use. We just don't. We do not need to eat them. We do not need to wear their skin. So let's just, you know, I'm not saying we should forget about pollution, obviously. And I mean, as we know, animal agriculture is majorly polluting. But there's other things that we do, including vegans do, which is very, very polluting. And you would be delusional if you didn't face up to that. And so try to be conscious of that. You know, if you can, if you are privileged enough to be able to buy biodegradable packaging and fair trade and veganic, if you can find veganic produce, that's just the most beautiful thing. Because that doesn't only mean no pesticides, it means no animal, you know, fertilizers and things like that. So, gosh. I hope I made some kind of sense. So it's been an hour. I should probably stop. But I guess I just wanted to, talk about it. I feel very upset about all of this literature that I'm reading that is about, oh, the amount of animals we used in vivisection is. One thing, I'll just finish up with that. So I've had plenty. So I wanted to tell you. So I wrote to my lecturer. We have to do a scientific paper, and it's a project. It's a an assignment, and we had to choose between either physiological or not neurological, but something like that content. And I just said to my professor, to my lecturer, I don't care what field you give me, as long as the paper that you assign me has zero reference to any animal vivisection, dissection, or any animal experimentation whatsoever. And I said, and if that's not possible, please let me know so we can discuss. And he wrote back and said, that's very easy to accommodate, absolutely fine. So I think I mentioned already that, when you read about these in the medical histories, a lot of these animal experimentation, they can't extrapolate it. It doesn't extrapolate. And you're thinking, oh, Anyway, but I'm waiting to have these conversations, and nobody's really breached them with me because I know that the vast majority of people I'm with support vivisection, you see, when it comes to ostensibly, supposedly helping, save human lives and stuff like that, right? So there's the thing. So when you are involved in that kind of community, the thing you have to remember is none of these people are vegan. None of these people eat a vegan diet. So of course they're going to support vivisection that they think first of all, they're deluded about how they think there's probably painkillers and it's all done very humanely and blah 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 blah. Well, they don't even think about it. But these are people who think nothing about buying the corpse of a helpless herbivore just because they taste good. Going and buying some shoes made out of the skin of, they think nothing about the most trivial use of animals. So address that. So I'm waiting for somebody to say, well, blah blah blah, vivisection, Elizabeth, because I do voice about it in my course, and nobody's actually said anything to me. I think they think things. I could tell you what I think they think, but of course I don't know what they're thinking. But nobody's actually responded. But if they do, if they say, well, look, gosh, Elizabeth, don't you think, it's justified, da 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 da, I'm going to say to them, I would happily have this conversation with you, and I'm grateful to you for starting this conversation. But first of all, I just want you to know that I think we're running before we can walk, because you're not, you eat animals, you still drink their milk and stuff. So can we talk about that? I mean, I'm happy if you don't, if you want to just talk about vivisection, we can talk about it, and I'll do my best, to address it. But I have to address it under the circumstance that you're a person who thinks perfectly normal and natural and justified to consume animals because they taste good, to wear little carry little bags made out of their skin because, you like the way they look, or put their body part, byproducts in your hair because it makes your hair shiny. I mean, if we can't address that, if that's where you're coming from, then of course you're going to support, vivisection that supposedly is saving human lives and advancing human health and stuff like that. So you see what I'm saying? And of course, I didn't ever figure any of this stuff out. I don't I learned all this stuff through Gary Francione's books and lectures, and then other conversations with abolitionists who were educated on the abolitionist approach. And luckily, I have the ability to have these conversations, and I can stride right in. You want to have a conversation about anything at all, even moral relativism. I hate moral relativism, but I can totally address it. But if you just get to the point where you're like, oh no, I think that rape is fine because that's the only way for me to win this argument, then I just say goodbye because I can't stand moral relativism. But I'm not afraid of it. I can address it because I learned how to address it, because I learned how to address all of these issues by reading Gary Francione's books. So, yeah, so, and by having conversations and practicing and stuff like that as well. So this is what I'm waiting for to happen with this course that I'm on. But it'll be an opportunity for me to talk about veganism, which means anti-vivisection. I'm not an anti-vivisectionist because that's limiting only to vivisection. I'm a vegan. I'm an abolitionist vegan. So of course I oppose vivisection and animal experimentation, but I oppose all animal use, all of it. and that's what I need to be presenting. So that's one of the things I have to be careful of in this course as well, is I don't want to come across, I don't want to support that species as a single issue and leave the animals who are used for food and, you know, throw them under the bus like most of these single, like all the single issue campaigns do. So I'm very quick that I oppose all animal use, and I'd have to be careful because I get sucked into the vivisection thing because that was the first thing that I learned about as a non-vegan, you know. So I need to be careful. You see how careful you have to be? You have to be consistent. You have to watch yourself. And I'm saying this out loud now because I'm reminding myself that not to present that you know, that the animals used for vivisection are more important than the animals used for milk or dairy or eggs, because they're not. Everybody's equally important. Humans who are killed for human slavery are no less or more important than women and children killed in genocide and war crimes. Or, you know, you don't need to make a hierarchy. You don't have to pick and choose. You can oppose it all. You can oppose it all. But I am grateful to the abolitionist approach because it's very useful. One of the first things I really remember learning was when I heard the concept by Gary Francione saying animal use, 99.9999% of animal use is transparently trivial. And then he said, so we can, you know, we can address that in a one minute conversation, and that can be addressed. Vivisection or animal experimentation for biomedical research, that's the only conversation that's the only use that's not transparently trivial, but it can still be addressed and it can still be opposed on the same moral grounds, and it's still just as unjustified. But that might be a 5 minute conversation as opposed to a 1 minute. And I just, it's true. So, but you have to, you know, you can't expect to have a conversation. It's just like about domestication, like pets. You know, I'm very open to people at the street stall that I oppose domestication. I've never had anybody say, you know, that it absolutely makes no sense, because we know what we're talking about and we tie it in, but we say to them, listen, you know, and while you're still eating animals because they taste good, it's going to be a little harder to, for us to have a conversation about pets, because I'm not saying that you can't handle it or whatever, but you see what I'm saying, when you're just using them every single day like nothing, and then you look at pet animals who you take to the vet and you give love and you care for them and you keep them safe as best you can and things, and you're saying, well, gosh, you know, what's wrong with that? You know, we have to address people's non-veganism. We have to address their habitual consumption and the most trivial reasoning of the amount of animals, and we can't forget about those animals. So it's all related, and I won't walk away from a conversation about vivisection, and I won't walk away from a conversation about domestication, but I'm very, very, very clear that we need to talk about all animal use. It always has to be in the context of all animal use. And most people don't vivisect, right? Most people don't actually do vivisection. They do, however, 3 times a day, 7 days a week, and every second in between, when they're wearing their shoes or washing their hair or whatever, use hundreds, personally, they're personally responsible for hundreds of deaths and inflictions of misery and torture and slaughter every year, at least, if not 1,000, I don't know the exact figure, I suppose it depends on how many eggs you eat or... You know, I don't like to break things down like that because every animal is important and I don't want it to just be a numbers game, but the numbers are staggering and you can use the numbers to give an idea. They're mind-boggling. They're beyond anything you can imagine. The amount of individual animals is just mind-boggling. So I have to say that there is an animal group at the University of Auckland. I'm not at the main campus in the city. I'm out in the other campus, but it's a very quiet campus far away. They're completely safe supporters and welfarists, 100%. I know this because Bubs went to Auckland Uni and he met them, and they were very open about that to him, that they were very supportive of SAFE and promote SAFE. Oh, this is just one little thing I'll add. Sorry, I know I'm rambling. So there's this vegan food fair coming up. So this is now the 3rd year that we've had a vegan food festival in Auckland, and it's only getting bigger every year. Okay, so I just laugh when I look back on all these people who are like, you can't promote veganism. It's just gonna make people run away. Yeah, whatever. So we have a vegan food fair, and I haven't been the 1st year. No, the 1st year, why didn't I go? I think I was. There was a reason. The 2nd year, Buddha was dying. That was last year. It's almost the anniversary of my baby girl's. Well, it's probably past the anniversary of her death. It's past the anniversary of her death. She died on the 11th of April. I try not to dwell on it. But anyway, I didn't go because she was dying. This year, I might go. I am on a budget, but if I just go and just have a little thing. But I kind of don't want to go because, as per usual, so this is the one thing I want to say. So when I first came back to New Zealand, and I was new vegan, but I was abolitionist, and I was jumping all over the vegan. There was this one vegan email group. It was just such a bad experience. But I was, and we started to really come down on SAFE, and that's the New Zealand Welfarist Group. We came down on them about not promoting veganism or mentioning veganism at all, and I regret that. I truly regret that challenge because they're not stupid. They're marketing. They're all about fundraising and about being popular and about appealing to the biggest amount of people that they can. So if they saw that there's some people, some new potential donors, right, potential money who want vegan advocacy, well, they'll just throw some of that in too. Hey, whatever works, right? Then they can talk out of both sides of their mouths and get as much money as possible. And I really regret pushing them. Not saying that I'm personally responsible for them, mentioning veganism more, but they certainly did it in response to this theme that we were pushing. And now they are. So whenever there's like a vegan thing, they're always going to be there. And I don't like that. I don't want them anywhere near vegan stuff because they're welfarist and they conflate veganism and non-veganism. They conflate veganism and vegetarianism. They confuse the issue. They keep it as this elite impossibility. They make it seem very hard. They condone animal use by the promotion of speciesist campaigns, and they're doing this now under a vegan banner sometimes, depending on their agenda. And that is very, very bad, and I really struggle with that. And I really wish that I had stayed far away from them, had nothing to do with them, didn't go anywhere near them, and just left them alone so that they never ever mentioned any vegan anything. Because I think that they are doing a lot of harm by conflating veganism with non-veganism. By when and somebody does go vegan. And they find out about veganism, then they're sucked into this whole welfarist thing. This is what I was talking about before. So you do have these new vegans, but the thing is, when you first go vegan, remember how overwhelming it was? Because it's so ubiquitous and it's so physically close to you. I mean, not only did you used to do it, like you used to chew that, you used to swallow that, it used to be part of your body, you used to put it on your skin and stuff. But when you stop doing it, but then you walk out into the streets and it's everywhere, and it's literally corpses, it's literally bits of flesh, it's literally pieces of the victims everywhere you go. You can smell it, you can see it. It's right next to you on the bus, it's right across from you in the restaurant, it's in your friend's mouth sitting next to you as you're on your break, and it can be quite a shock because I think maybe it was like when people woke up to anti-slavery, as let's say in the United States, the abolitionists against race-based slavery, and slavery was everywhere. So they had this realization. They woke up, and then they would go to their neighbor's house, and there would be slaves. And I think that's probably a way of describing what it's like for vegans. So they get desperate, and then of course, so many people aren't vegan. Very few people in their personal lives are vegan. So they reach out to the community, and the vast majority of the community is the welfarist movement, and they have events, and they do have great. I mean, vegan food is amazing. So they have these vegan food events, but then it's all part of their fundraising. It's all part of getting support for their welfarism, and then they re-indoctrinate these poor vegans with this fatalistic, defeatist attitude. about how nobody else is going to go vegan, ignoring the fact that these are some very new vegans right in front of them. So they went vegan. And it's just this, I just have a really hard time. I just am very, very, very sad about that. I mean, obviously I wish SAFE and everybody would be unequivocal about veganism, but then they could not survive as an organization because there's a career, there's people who make money. I mean, this, they have to pay their bills, and bills are thousands and tens of thousands of dollars a year. You need, you know, if you live in Auckland and you want to pay your rent, and you want to survive, I mean, you have to make, I mean, I don't know how you can survive on less than $30,000, $25,000 a year. And that would be very bare bones. Maybe you'd be sharing with a lot of other people. I mean, maybe, I'm sure there are people living on less than that, but that would be very, very low wages. I mean, if you're thinking about the rent in Auckland, your average rent, I think, like, if you want to rent like a three-bedroom house, I think they're asking like $700, you know. And then, so let's say there's like six of you, you have that, and then electricity bills are so shockingly high, and then food bills, even if you're buying the bulk stuff, is really, really expensive. Gasoline is really expensive if you have a car. So I mean, it can be done. I'm sure you can live on less, but what I'm saying is these people from SAFE, they don't live on $25,000 a year. I mean, I'm pretty damn sure. I mean, I guess I could go and try and find out, but what I'm trying to say is they have to collect all this money for, you know, they couldn't, you know, they need their fundraising, and they're not going to get their fundraising by having veganism as a moral baseline, because that's not how you make money. But anyway, so there's this vegan food fair, and of course they can't leave alone. So there's somebody from SAFE there going to be talking. Now, I don't believe they're going to be talking about their organization. I believe they're going to be talking about parenting vegan children. So let's hope they just stick to that and they don't promote their organization at all, but they will. And SAFE will probably be there. And so I kind of don't want to go, which is silly. I should just go and enjoy the food. But I just, that's why it's funny. I avoid a lot of the animal events because they're all welfareist and I just don't like it. I'd rather go to something neutral. I know that sounds strange, because if I went to the animal welfare conference, which they call the animal rights conference, which it's not, in Auckland, it would be vegan food, and everybody around me, well, I don't think everybody, I think there might be non-vegans there, but, you know, most people around me would be vegan. But I just, it would be worse for me than going to a festival where, I know this sounds strange, but, I mean, it's nice to only be around vegan food and all that, but the welfareism, I just can't deal with it. And you have such a hard time advocating to welfare. I have such a hard time. I mean, I have way better results talking to non-vegans in the street about veganism and getting them turned on to the idea and getting them thinking about the idea of abolishing domestication. I mean, that's what we talk about. That's what abolitionist advocacy talks about. We don't pussyfoot around the issues, you know. We're very clear, and we have amazing breakthrough conversations with people. It might be the first conversation they've ever had, and so we know that they might not go vegan instantly. Oh, I've said that, you know, I'm not even going to address that. So, but then I have a much harder time and a much more frustrating time, generally speaking, talking to anti-abolitionist vegans, because that's what a lot of welfareists are now. You know, and we could say we're anti-welfareist, and I'll happily wear that label if you want to call me that. I am an anti-welfareist vegan. Otherwise known as an abolitionist vegan. And I find it to be a lot harder to deal with. And I don't know, there's lots of reasons why, I'm sure. But, but anyway, despite all of this, and you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the fact that the word vegan is being used by these groups a lot more. I mean, I should probably relax about that, because even though they are conflating it and they are mixing it up with non-veganism, that's kind of happening out in the general stream anyway. I mean, you read these articles about people who eat honey and call themselves vegan and stuff. I mean, this isn't going to be an endless thing that we're addressing, but maybe all of this extra mention of the word, you know, I should give people benefit of the doubt that the general public, who are kind of sucked into these welfare things, but they see the word vegan because these welfareist groups are putting it out there. Hey, maybe that is contributing to the amount, you know, maybe the I do believe in the promotion of veganism as being this incredible tool and this education. So maybe it's not such a regret that these welfareist groups are using it a lot more, and maybe that is contributing to the more awareness. I mean, obviously. So I guess, okay, maybe it's not that bad. I mean, it's better than that they don't. Like, I just a minute ago said I wish that they mentioned nothing at all about veganism. Maybe I don't really mean that. I don't know. It's very confusing. I'll have to think about that some more, because what I see a lot of them doing is, mixing it up with non-veganism. But no, I think I've just changed my mind. I think it's good that we've forced these groups to at least acknowledge that veganism exists and what it means, generally speaking, although they do get it twisted, and the fact that they are, a lot of their members and a lot of the paid staff are vegans. That has to intrigue some people to check out what veganism is, and we can only hope that they check it out on it. They get, you know, they move towards an abolitionist place. Maybe they'll find an abolitionist website when they do their searching, even though they first saw it on a safe, you know, thing. Maybe so. Okay, maybe it wasn't such a bad move. I mean, I am very disappointed in the terrible speciesism in the animal movement. It never fails to shock me, and it's an ongoing debate, which we will keep having. It's a necessary debate. Anyway, what I'm doing at the moment is trying to get my degree so that I can become an audiologist. I might be the first vegan audiologist. I doubt it. Maybe in New Zealand, but that's not hard to be the first vegan anything in New Zealand at the moment. Maybe I will be the first vegan audiologist if I can make it through this course. I'm sure I'll do my best. And then I will be able to go back. Oh, just want a shout out to Jeff and Jason and Tanya for keeping the stall going. So they have been doing it, which is so nice. So they've done it a few times. The vegan street stall, the abolitionist vegan street stall on Queen Street, and that's just so comforting to me, because I will be getting back to that once I graduate from university. I will, once I've got a routine again where I'm studying, I mean where I'm not studying, although I will, as a new audiologist, I will still be learning this very complex field, and I will still be very busy and probably going to seminars and things. I'll still have a lot more free time than I do now, and I definitely will go back to doing my street stall, because I love doing my street stall. But in the meantime, Jeff and Jason are keeping it going for me. Well, not for me, they're keeping it going and they're doing it, and they've got all the gear. They just took out over everything, so huge shout out to them. Thank you so much for keeping that going. And Tanya, who drives up from the Waikato whenever she can. It's quite a journey, so that's not something that can be done every weekend, but shout out for Tanya for making that effort. It's wonderful to have them doing that, and it makes me smile. All right, well, thanks so much for listening. You know, keep up the good work, and all of you, and don't get despairing, don't give up. Remember, it can happen. It's not like we're trying to make it where everybody has to grow wings and fly. We're actually working for something that's actually doable. Okay? It is. You did it. So just keep that in mind. Don't be despairing. Okay? All right. I guess I'll be back, and I hope that you're having a good spring or autumn, depending on where you live. Bye.